100 years ago, in January of the year 1924, a newspaper called the New York Tribune published a short article promoting an upcoming concert. Paul Whiteman and his Royal Orchestra, it claimed, would offer an experiment in modern music. It said that George Gershwin, the 25-year-old Jewish-American composer of Broadway musicals, was writing a piece for that concert. Something new, something called a jazz concerto. This came as a surprise to Gershwin. According to one version of the story, he had forgotten that he was commissioned to write anything for this concert until he saw it in the paper. So, he sat at the piano with empty pages of sheet music and a pencil, and he scrambled to write something. He had spent years becoming familiar with the rising jazz scene in Harlem, and over the course of just 10 days, he composed what is now regarded as one of the most iconic pieces of music ever written, Rhapsody in Blue. But that's not the whole story. And the whole story is not so clean-cut. This is the story of the American melting pot and all the baggage that comes with it. This is the story of inspiration, appropriation, and reinvention. This is the story of a song. This is Ear Buddies. Hello, Ear Buddies Army. Timmy here. Maddie will be back next week. You know, Matt and I are complex young men. Always have been, and God willing, we always will be. We have this ability, Matt and me, to hold two conflicting ideas in our heads at the same time. And listen, that ability that I have a feeling you share as well, will be very important in this discussion of this tune, Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin. I mean, from that opening clarinet lick, you know what it is. You know this tune. Of course you do. Maybe you've flown on American Airlines and seen their in-flight safety video that features this song. Or maybe you watched Leonardo DiCaprio introduce himself and raise his glass as Jay Gatsby in the critically acclaimed 2013 film. Or, you know, maybe you've just been alive in America, because this is a very big American tune, and it just turned 100, so a lot of people are talking about it right now. And you know, Matt and Tim, you know we don't just jump on the bandwagon. We are not bandwagon guys. We only do this if we really have something to say, which today, doggone it, we do. It's time to talk about this tune. Now, before I start, I want to say that this episode owes a lot to the work of Ryan Benegale, who teaches music at Colorado College. He literally wrote a book about Rhapsody in Blue. So much of what I'll be saying today is thanks to his great scholarship. All right, folks, context. That's what we need. We need context. So who is George Gershwin? Well, he's a guy who was born in New York City, 1898. What a year. And, you know, he grew up on the mean streets, right? He quit school at age 15 because he loved music so much, and he decided to give up his education and become what is called a song plugger. This is one of those old-timey jobs that I think is would have been so cool. A song plugger is a guy or gal who would sit in a department store at a piano or maybe a music store, just, you know, various well-traveled shops in the city, and get people to buy the sheet music of those tunes. So he's basically the 1913 version of, you know, a 30-second song preview that you'd get in the iTunes store.
Girl has sung so classy as this fair lassie. Oh, oh, oh my goodness, what a chassis.
That was George's job. And, you know, he starts writing some of his own stuff and starts plugging some of his own tunes, has a big break, and finds himself writing tunes for Broadway. Excellent. Now, George was a unique guy because he loved jazz. So jazz at this time in New York is evolving out of ragtime and blues. And it basically is all happening in Harlem. So it's very much a black art at this time. And it's taking off like crazy. This time period eventually gets called the Harlem Renaissance because of how many visionary artists were kind of sculpting what jazz would eventually become. So George thought this was awesome, and he would go to Harlem, and he would watch these jazz cats, you know, doing their thing, innovating, and he gets to know even some of the great jazz piano players personally. Guys like Willie the Lion Smith, who you are hearing right now. And Gershwin's love of jazz ultimately influences the kind of music that he writes. So along comes a guy in 1923 named Paul Whiteman, who is a band leader in New York. He wants to put on an all-jazz concert to commemorate Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Great. Abe would have loved jazz, I'm sure. And he wants some cool new music for this concert, so he asks his old pal George to write something. And he's a great marketer, so he positions this concert as an experiment in modern music. You know, very much trying to stir up fervor and get people saying, whoa, is this even allowed? Can we do this? Can we put jazz on the classical music stage? So that's the vibe that is being created. And if you heard, you know, you heard the story at the top, George essentially forgets that he agreed to this because he was focused on writing other things for Broadway. And then he hears about it again in the paper. And he says, oh man, I gotta turn this in. My deadline's coming up soon. So he scrambles to write Rhapsody in Blue. Now, he did not write each individual instrument part. He basically writes a condensed version of this tune. Like the piano part, although even some of that he makes up on the fly in performance, and then just a couple, you know, kind of chords and things underneath it of like, here's what the rest of the instruments should be doing. So a guy named Ferdy Groffé had this really important task of taking that condensed version and scaling it up to the whole orchestra. And that's a name that nobody, Ferdy Groffé, what? That's not a name. But he was super important in creating, you know, this, what ultimately becomes like one of the most iconic and like groundbreaking pieces of music of the 20th century. So give it up for Ferdy. Anyway, it all comes together. And then in February of 1924, you end up with this. So that famous opening clarinet slide was not actually written on the page. It was just a joke that the clarinet player did in rehearsal. Like, he really like leaned into the jazz of it all, and Gershwin loved it and said, "Will you please do that in the performance?" And so they kept it. And now Some people say it's just as famous as in terms of like recognizable classical music licks. I mean, maybe so, yeah. So let me read you a quote from George himself, Mr. Gershwin, talking about this piece. He says, quote, "I heard it as a sort of musical kaleidoscope of America, of our vast melting pot, of our unduplicated national pep, of our blues, of our metropolitan madness." Isn't that so good? And can't you hear all of that in this tune? Is this not the sound of metropolitan madness? It's such an evocative tune, and these melodies, I mean, it feels corny at this point to even say it, but this just sounds like the 1920s in a way that very few things do. It's really cool. So it's a rhapsody, right? Rhapsody in blue. What is a rhapsody? It's basically a bunch of musical ideas all mashed together and jumping around. There's no real like structure that the composer adheres to. They just kind of do whatever feels right, which is a lot of fun. And so Gershwin wrote a bunch of excellent themes. That opening one, probably the most famous now, is known as the jazz theme. There's a bit that is now known as the train theme. You can kind of hear the drum doing like a chugga-chugga-chugga thing here. And Gershwin actually said that a lot of the inspiration for Rhapsody in Blue came to him while he was riding on the train. So we'll just walk through kind of the five big identifiable parts of the rhapsody. This next one is the stride theme. So listen to the low bass notes here, followed by the chords, kind of boom, chord, boom, chord, that thing. This is meant to mimic a technique of piano playing called stride piano that is almost ragtimey, and this is what was big in Harlem jazz at this time. So Gershwin and Ferdy Groffay, the arranger, basically tried to mimic the sound of a stride piano spread out to a whole orchestra. You've got another section here that's called the shuffle section that, again, also feels a little ragtimey, kind of syncopated. You can picture this on a jangly piano, and it works. And then, of course, there's a slow, schmaltzy, gorgeous section that is referred to as the love theme. And for about 15 minutes, Rhapsody in Blue just kind of bounces around all these themes, again, with no real order. It's just George doing what feels right at the time, measure to measure. Folks, the crowd loved this. The crowd went bonkers over it. And in part because it actually was a really novel thing. It was an experiment in modern music, like the marketing materials said. It had five really good melodies, yeah? And no one had ever heard this before. Think about like how crazy that is in a way. No one had heard classical instruments doing jazz chords and jazz rhythms and jazz melodies. So by essentially every measure, George crushed it. people loved it. He goes on to superstardom in the world of classical and like Broadway musical composition. He writes some more tunes that become jazz standards, basically, like Summertime is a really famous jazz tune. He hit, you know, it was a bullseye through and through. And orchestras to this day are still performing this all the time, all around the world. Everybody wants to hear Rhapsody in Blue played live by an orchestra because it's a crowd pleaser. But remember what I said about two conflicting ideas and holding them in your head at the same time. All right, get ready, because we're doing that now. And we have to start with the idea of the vast melting pot. Those were George Gershwin's own words that he used to describe this song. The idea of the melting pot is one that I think sounds great, right? We imagine every culture sort of contributing their own little thing to the stew. And then you end up with this delicious, you know, feast for the senses, a smorgasbord. But what ultimately tends to happen is people who are not in the majority culture, you know, immigrants and descendants of slaves, find that their culture gets smoothed over, you know, kind of sandpapered down and mixed in with what is the dominant culture. That was a pretty common thing, or at least maybe a common expectation among many in the majority culture, as they're saying, come do things our way instead, please. So let's go back to Paul Whiteman. He's the band leader who commissions the composition of Rhapsody in Blue. And again, he's got this mind for marketing. He says it's a great experiment in modern music. But here are some other things he said. He said he wanted to, quote, make a lady out of jazz. And the playbill that concertgoers received in February of 1924 said, quote, Mr. Whiteman intends to point out, with the assistance of his orchestra and associates, the tremendous strides which have been made in popular music from the day of the discordant jazz to the really melodious music of today, end quote. So it's introducing this idea that jazz was somehow unpleasant and discordant and not suitable for the sort of high-minded classical music stage. But now that all changes, right? It's time to bring it into the fold of classical music. That's how this was pitched. And that's not great, you know? I mean, I'm, of course, speaking 100 years later. But even at that time, there were black artists who felt that Gershwin had stolen from them by composing this piece and taking music that he had heard in Harlem and turning it into something for the traditionally white classical music stage and audience. There was an old short film that came out several years after Rhapsody in Blue called St. Louis Blues. And has an all-black cast, and all the music, except for one little bit, is composed by a black composer, W.C. Handy, who is known as the father of the blues. But there's a scene where a woman is pickpocketed, and when it is revealed that she was stolen from, instead of W.C. Handy's music, Rhapsody in Blue starts to play. Folks, I doubt I need to explain the subtext of that to you. I think you probably get it. And when one considers the phenomenon status of Rhapsody in Blue, how this song just exploded in popularity after borrowing or stealing, depending on how you view it, black art, it is certainly easy to understand this perspective. But again, our complex minds. So allow me to put forth another possibility here, another way to view this whole thing. And the place to start is, well, of course, an episode of Ear Buddies. Episode 21, The Ear Buddies Guide to Cultural Appropriation, Volume 1, in which we talked about Paul Simon. Do you remember what we said about Paul, folks? We said that if an artist is well-intentioned and does their homework, the borrowing or theft or appropriation of culture should not be regarded as a malicious act necessarily. So, and we were talking about Paul Simon, right? And we were praising him for Graceland, the album that he wrote and recorded after becoming intimately familiar with African music.
He said, I have no opinion about this, and I have no opinion about that.
And then he came back to a studio stateside and made this sort of Afro-fusion pop album that was, by all accounts, a major success. And it is appropriative, but it's done so with reverence to the music that he loved. And his goal was to get more people to love that music. So in that case, yes, it is cultural borrowing. You could call it theft, but it's done so in a very positive spirit. And I would posit that George Gershwin put in that kind of work. I think it's also worth noting that George Gershwin was a Jewish American, and I would not necessarily describe the 1920s as like a beautiful, gorgeous, harmonious time to be living as a Jewish American. So it's very safe to call him a member of a minority population too. But more importantly for this case, he spent time studying these great jazz players in Harlem. He learned about stride piano. He got to know stride pianists. He loved this music and he was inspired by it. So it's natural that he would both, you know, I think intuitively make music that sounds like it, but also want to do so. It's natural to, you know, to write what you're enthusiastic about. Now, I do think a person can take issue with the way the piece was marketed. The idea of making a lady out of jazz is gross. Like, the idea that jazz needed to be tamed in some way is antiquated and not great. And I know it was 100 years ago, and the world was highly segregated at that time. But I think if black artists could call it out then, which they did, we can certainly call it out now. But for art to be groundbreaking, I think it has to break new ground. And look, this is Timmy's take, right? Take it or leave it. You may disagree. But I think George got it. I think he knew what he was doing, and I think he did so respectfully. And holy smokes, did he, to use a much beloved phrase on this podcast, did he understand the assignment or what? Paul Whiteman said, please write me a jazz concerto. And, I mean, George did that and then some. He wrote a piece that didn't just bring jazz into this classical space, you know, bring it into the high sensibility space. I think he, to this day, because it is still such a popular piece, he wrote something that introduces people to jazz in a gorgeous way. People who may not otherwise be interested in jazz, but maybe they love classical music, will hear this piece and think, that is neat. I would like to hear more of that, please. So, to that, I say, congrats, Mr. Gershwin. You nailed it. Those melodies are so good. And they're authentic. They are authentic 1920s Harlem jazz, written by a guy who truly loved that music and put in the hard work to do it right. I want to give the last word on this matter to someone who has been brought up on this podcast before in our episode about bluegrass. It's Bela Fleck. This is a guy who is an amazing banjo player and is like really innovative in that space. And Bela wrote a really nice article to mark the 100-year anniversary of Rhapsody in Blue. He wrote it for just some random public radio, like a local public radio website, of all things. I have linked it in the show notes. And Bela goes to bat for Rhapsody in Blue. He defends it pretty strongly. And he says, he has this quote that I'll share with you now about the idea of cultural borrowing and the melting pot and everything we've been talking about up to this point. He says, quote, "America's music is innovative and full of endless possibilities because of the way we are moved by the diversity of thought and culture that we are submerged in. We must face harms done, reclaim histories with truer narratives, and adapt our humanity in this moment to create space, opportunity, and justice for voices pushed away from the stages, curricula, and fame." End quote. I think that's a really beautiful and nicely put sentiment. American music is great because of our diversity, not in spite of it. And the more we can all do to be mindful and respectful of the true origins of things and the nuance of things and just making sure that we do right by everybody, we are left in a better place. We're left with brilliant music. So to that end, Bela Fleck just released an album called Rhapsody in Blue. And it's Bela Fleck on the banjo, surrounded by his typical bluegrass instrumentation, playing Rhapsody in Blue, like a new arrangement that Bela made. And it's so cool. You really should check it out. Listen to the whole thing. I think you'll love it. And it is an example of hearing something that is maybe outside his culture, loving it, revering it, and making it his own, and moving art and moving music forward in his way. So I will leave you with an excerpt of Rhapsody in Bluegrass by Bela Fleck, George Gershwin, and Ferdy Grafay. Do not forget about Ferdy, please. Thank you for listening to Ear Buddies. Bye-bye.